Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming.
We have for some years now conducted six monthly bilateral talks between the Prime Minister of New Zealand and Australia, likewise the Minister of Finance and Treasurer of Australia and Foreign Ministers as well and others. So we've just concluded with the Honourable Alexander Downer, the Foreign Minister for Australia, very successful talks this morning. Continuing on from the informal meeting last night. So if you have any questions, now's your time to ask them.
What was on the agenda, Mr. Pearson?
On the agenda? Obviously Pacific issues, the various national engagements such as Timor, the Solomon Islands, Fiji, Tonga, Papua New Guinea, African issues to do with Asia, the new East Asia Summit organisation, APEC itself, which is being hosted by Australia this year in September, and wider issues to do with the interfaith dialogue coming up in May this year at Waitangi, so it was quite comprehensive.
Will you two be presenting a united front, presumably, will be at select foreign ministers over Fiji?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly will. Let me just say a couple of things by way of introduction. Certainly I appreciate the opportunity of being here in Wellington today and catching up with Winston. Also, I've met with Phil Gough this morning, and I'm seeing the Prime Minister later today. And our relationship with New Zealand is, of course, centrally important to Australia. And over recent years, it's been an extremely strong relationship, and I think part of that strength is the cooperation has been between us in the Pacific. We've had a lot of problems in the Pacific, and of course in East Timor as well, but the cooperation between Australia and New Zealand has been very intimate and very successful. So in terms of Fiji, we've taken very similar measures to each other, and we've consulted each other throughout all of this process of the coup in Fiji, and now we've received copies of the Eminent Persons Group report. We hope there'll be a sort of scheduled, I think, a meeting of Pacific Island Forum foreign ministers on the 16th of March in Port Vila at Vanuatu, when we will certainly be taking a common position in response to that report, which we might not take the common position, publicise our common position now, but wait until the meeting and show appropriate respect to our ministerial colleagues there. But I mean, in an overall sense, I think the Eminent Persons Group has done a good job, but there'll certainly be a common position between Australia and New Zealand.
So when would you like to see Fiji return to democracy? I mean, Wayne Moran is talking about it until 2010.
Well, we would like to see Fiji return to democracy as quickly as possible, and they clearly need a roadmap, but not a roadmap that is 4 years long, or, 3.5 years long. I think they need to get back to democracy very quickly. That's not just because countries like Australia and New Zealand believe very passionately in democracy, but because that's important to the broader economic and social development of Fiji. Having the country run by the military isn't going to be much of an option for the country in over a period of years. So the quicker they can, hand over to a civil, democratic government, the better.
Logistically, there's no impediment to Fiji having an early election within a matter of months. In fact, you've got to remember that the rolls in May of 2006 were at about 92%, which is an achievement that many Western democracies would love to aspire to. So basically the problem is the commander returning to his barracks and realizing that the overall authority with respect to the military does not lie with the army, but it lies with, in fact, the elected government and the president.
Have you had any direct talks with the commander since he came to New Zealand?
Yes, but pre the coup.
Not post the coup.
Not post the coup.
Have you talked about any further measures both countries can take to put pressure on Fiji to return to democracy?
I think the measures we've taken, the smart sanctions in particular, are proving, as a matter of fact, to be quite effective. You see, the balance here has to be a balance between taking measures that affect those people in Fiji who are responsible for acting illegally in this way and making sure that the ordinary people of Fiji don't pay a penalty as well. So they're obviously paying a penalty in the sense that tourist numbers are down, the economy will turn down as a result of what Commodore Bainimarama has done. That, of course, is damaging to the economy in itself. But I think these sanctions on travel by people who are involved in the coup or have participated in an illegal government and stopping them travelling to Australia and New Zealand, I think they are very effective. I do. And they obviously, for all sorts of different reasons, causes quite a lot of pain for those people. And I want to focus our efforts on the people responsible for this coup, not and the people who have participated in it, not on the ordinary people of Fiji. I don't want to punish them. I mean, I'm sure the vast majority of them didn't want a coup. And what is more, they all went out and expressed their view last year in the general election. We all know what they think, and they don't think this is the right thing to do.
Can I just say one thing
to add to that? I mean, it's very easy to slide into the view that Australia and New Zealand are punishing Fiji. We are not. Australia and New Zealand have taken these measures to see a quick return to democracy. A totally different objective.
The argument that Licinia and Garrison should be returned to office, that's obviously an argument that hasn't got any currency anymore.
Well, obviously it would be nice if the democratically elected government would be returned to office, but I get, I don't want to stray into unreality in diplomacy. I mean, I think that is clearly not about to happen. And what we would like to see is a roadmap that will bring Fiji back into democracy and hopefully never repeat this. I had several coups now over the years, going back to 1987. Coups are becoming a habit there, and they're doing their country so much damage. They're doing the whole Pacific region's reputation so much damage by this constant coup making, and they really need to get over coups and and embrace democratic institutions. And most people in Fiji do that. It seems that the military finds it very difficult to respect democratic institutions. So we look forward to a roadmap back to democracy and a rapid return to democracy.
And Mr. Dunn, do you see no benefit or relevance in Bainimarama's proposal to remove the race-based voting system in Fiji and replace it with a common role across the whole community?
Well, I think military commanders aren't the people who are qualified to talk about how to run a country. I think the ordinary people of the country themselves, and through a process of democratic evolution, a constitution should be built, not by a military commander just coming in and seizing power. Of course, he's making all sorts of arguments about how the constitution could be improved and criticisms of the previous constitution. Whether I agree with those arguments or not isn't the point. What is the military commander doing? Taking over control of the whole country and stipulating how the constitution should be written. I mean, it seems to me that his job is to defend the country from foreign invasion, which isn't a problem for Fiji, to make sure that the military force is well trained and capable of performing the various tasks that the democratically elected government wants them to perform, in particular in Fiji's case in a range of peacekeeping operations. His job is not to be a politician. I told him that to his face. He is not a politician, and now of course he's called himself the Prime Minister. He's finding that job a little more difficult than he had imagined. It's a little more complicated being the Prime Minister of a country than running a military force. So now we need a roadmap back to democracy, and how the electoral system works and all of that, whether the old constitution is just going to be resuscitated or there are some changes to that constitution. That should be a matter for civil society, not for a military commander.
Mr. Peters, on Iran, there are reports that the Pentagon has set up a panel to discuss ways or look at ways of a possible military strike. Are you concerned, or what's your reaction to the possibility that the US might make a military strike against Iran?
Well, as you say, there are reports. I've not seen them. I don't know whether they're authoritative, whether they're a fact. They are media reports.
What is your view about whether it's legitimate or wise to consider a military action against Iran?
Well, the question for New Zealand in that context doesn't arise. I'd like to if there are measures and moves and designs and plans for such an action, I'd comment on them when I saw them, when we knew that they were a potential reality. But our position with respect to the desire for peaceful resolution of differences between countries, our position has never changed in recent years, not changing now.
I think there's an effort by some commentators to try to whip up a bit of a campaign here against the Bush administration for reasons that aren't necessarily to do with Iran, by suggesting that what happened in Iraq in 2003 is going to happen in Iran, and no amount of denying of this by the administration should be taken seriously. Can I just say, the American position is perfectly clear. What they say is that they never, in any circumstance, and this is true of the Clinton administration and administrations going back well before his administration, always the position they always took, that the United States never rules anything in or out. They don't get into doing that. But they, the leadership in the United States is not on the threshold of launching military action against Iran. What has happened in relation to Iran is that Iran has failed to comply with the demands of the United Nations Security Council. So I would urge people, instead of making sort of political points at the expense of the American administration, to focus on the central issue here, which is that Iran is in breach of the demands of the United Nations Security Council, and the concern of the international community should be, and I think at the diplomatic level is, how are we going to get Iran to comply with the demands of the Security Council to cease its enrichment programs and to cooperate fully and in a transparent and open way with the International Atomic Energy Agency. I mean, here we are in New Zealand, which is a country which has, you know, historically been very concerned about nuclear weapons and nuclear power. So I think in New Zealand the concern should be, what are we going to do now that Iran has not complied with Security Council resolution? But the American administration isn't planning a military attack on Iran, and nobody's ever said they were, apart from some commentators. So instead of beating up on the Bush administration, I think people should be beating up on, I could use it in the nicest possible way, diplomatically beating up on President Ahmadinejad and encouraging him to respect the United Nations. In New Zealand, people respect the United Nations. They think Security Council resolutions are important. Then let's get behind the Security Council and the United Nations.
Could you discuss the Australian increase in
Afghanistan?
I told, well, I just say what I said. I told Winston that we were giving thought to providing to strengthening our military capability in Afghanistan, but we haven't made any final decisions in relation to that yet.
What are our plans, Mr. Peters, in terms of increasing any role in Afghanistan?
We're in about the same position as Australia in the context of considering what our future responsibilities and engagement might be in numbers and resources. We have yet to make a decision upon that.
As it, the last, Mr. Goss said about a week ago that you'd be looking into cabinet, essentially that numbers stay the same and just roll over the current commitments. Are you saying that you're talking about an increase in numbers?
No, I'm just saying that the matter has not gone before cabinet, it's not been finalised. We've not The government has not made a decision on that issue yet.
Mr. Downer, are you confident that Solomon Islands is going to renew the Ramsey mandate this year and that Australia will be remain part of it?
Well, I think if Australia wasn't part of Ramsey, it would collapse. It wouldn't really, it would cease to exist because we put $250 million a year into Ramsey and it's we are the bankroller of it, and of course the a very large percentage of the personnel in Ramsey come from Australia. I think the people of the Solomon Islands regard Ramsey as a wonderful thing. I think it has been and it has been a wonderful thing. It has helped to re-establish health services. It's helped to re-establish education. It's brought some semblance of order back into public finance. It's got the economy growing again. So the criticisms of Ramsey are criticisms by people who have an alternative agenda, which is not an agenda which is consistent with the broader aspirations of the ordinary people of Solomon Islands. I think that just about everybody outside of the political class, if I could put it that way, in Solomon Islands strongly supports Ramsey. And there aren't many people in Solomon Islands who want to go back to the status quo ante, back to where Solomon Islands was, particularly between 2000 and 2003. So I'm confident in that the very strong views of the Solomon Islands public are reflected amongst not all of, but many of the and the vast majority of members of the Solomon Islands Parliament.
Mr. Downer, did you discuss the Australian government's view on Iraq?
We didn't much, no, but I'm happy to tell you what our view about Iraq is, that is you have a choice here between the insurgents and the terrorists winning in Iraq, and if that's your, I don't mean you personally, sure it's not true of you personally actually, but if that is people's preference they should make it clear that it is, or the democratic institutions of Iraq assisted by the international forces there winning in the sense of ensuring the insurgents and the terrorists aren't able to take control of the country and the democratic institutions can survive and the Iraqi security forces can take over the country. That's the choice. Now, it seems to me that for countries like Australia and New Zealand, we unequivocally would want the democratic institutions of Iraq to win out, and we would want the Americans to help them win out. And we are talking here about problems on a micro scale compared to Iraq, about, you know, the Solomon Islands and so on. And here we are at this press conference talking of our passionate support for democracy, political stability, economic progress and prosperity in the Pacific. Well, I don't confine my support for those things to the Pacific. I include the Middle East in my agenda, and I want democracy, I want prosperity, I want our allies to prevail in Iraq, and they can prevail, and I'm confident with the right political will they will prevail. I don't want to see the terrorists and the insurgents win, and if they do, I know what the consequences will be. All the advice that I have had, all the advice that I have had is that if the terrorists and the insurgents win in Iraq, the democratic institutions are destroyed, the Americans and their allies humiliated and defeated, then the consequences in terms of the war against terrorism, including right down into our neighbourhood in Southeast Asia, will be dire. And at the end of the day, my first responsibility is to the people of Australia and Australia's security. And Australia's security will be substantially diminished by a victory by the terrorists and the insurgents in Iraq. I know that.
Mr.
There's one Australian citizen that's been held without bail for 5 years, though. Now, why is the UK doing so well at getting its citizens back, and that Australia seems to be having a bit of a problem getting Mr. Hicks?
We got Habib back, because you're probably not really familiar with all of this, because I think from the structure of your question, you're not familiar with all the details.
And
not, no reason for you to be, of course, in New Zealand. But we had two Australians who were taken into Guantanamo Bay, and after some time, we said to the Americans that if they're not going to charge these people, they should release them. They shouldn't stay in Guantanamo Bay without charges. They said that... for one reason or another, which I won't go into here, they wouldn't charge Habib, and so they released him. In the case of Hicks, they said they would charge Hicks, and they brought charges against Hicks, and there were appeals, some by Hicks, some by others, and in particular an appeal by a man called Hamden, who was Osama bin Laden's driver. Ultimately, all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled that the military commissions, in which Hicks was to be tried, had not been constituted by an act of Congress, but by an executive order, and it should be constituted by an act of Congress. So Congress subsequently enacted legislation to establish the military commissions, and Hicks is now facing charges and trial in the military commission, but this has taken an inordinately long period of time, a bit like this answer to your question, taken an inordinately long period of time, and we have been unhappy about the time it's taken. That might not all be the fault of the American administration, but to some extent it is their fault, and we've made that very clear to everybody from the president downwards. We had Dick Cheney in Sydney yesterday, day before yesterday, and the day before that, and the Prime Minister and I and others made it clear to him that we wanted this case expedited. So we'll see. I mean, we are obviously concerned about Australians who get into situations as Hicks has apparently got into, where allegedly he has belonged to four different terrorist organisations, the Kosovo Liberation Front, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda and Laskar-e-Toiba, which is an anti-Indian terrorist organisation. I mean, that is a matter, if those allegations are true, that is a matter of enormously deep concern when you're trying to struggle in a war against terrorism. So we take those allegations seriously, not lightly, and we expect him to be tried, and hopefully that trial will happen soon. As soon as the trial is finished, regardless of the results of the trial, acquitted or convicted, he will be able to return to Australia. He will be released from Guantanamo Bay when the trial is complete, so he can serve his sentence, if there is one to serve in Australia, or else he will of course be released. So anyway, the sooner that is over and done with, the better.
Mr. Peters, Mr. Downer was suggesting before that this corner of the world would be less safe if the insurgents and the terrorists win in Iraq and if the Allied troops pull out. Would you agree with that?
Well, our position in New Zealand is clearly to seek an outcome in Iraq where there is a democratic government in control of it. The fact that we have a difference of opinion regarding the origins of the intervention is not the issue now. The issue now is how can there be an exit from Iraq where there's a successful self-governing democracy without outside intervention. And that is briefly and bluntly opposition still. Anything we can do as a country, even now, is to assist in that occurring outside of direct military engagement, but in other ways, New Zealand would seek to do.
Could that be achieved, that goal be achieved, with military withdrawal?
Well, you're asking me for an opinion as to whether that would be a sound step at this point in time. I'll give you my opinion. I cannot see how it would advantage that happening right now in February of 2007. I think the circumstances would slide us into total chaos if that was to happen.
The problem, the
all we talked about, doesn't it feel that you appear to be losing that sort of political war at home?
I don't think so. I think, well, at home you mean in Australia. Look, I don't think so. I think in Australia the view of the Australian public, whatever they, it's a bit what Winston has just said, whatever they may think about the original decision to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and, you know, there may be people in Australia who think it would have been better to have left the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein in power. That isn't, of course, the decision that we face today. He's gone. The decision we face today is just what we've been talking about. Should we, well, you know, we, should the coalition, particularly the Americans, just withdraw from Iraq and leave it, as Winston has said, in a state of complete chaos? Or should we continue to build up the Iraqi security forces to the point where they're able to sustain security in the country and the democratic government is able to survive? I think when you put it to people that way, people probably on balance agree with that proposition. Then there's another issue: should Australia be involved in all of this, or should we leave it to the Americans? Well, you know, I suppose it sort of gets to the notion of mateship in Australia, really. I mean, do you just abandon your mates? We say to the Americans, you do it all, we're just going to abandon you. Or do we stick by them? And I think we feel, in the end, we'll stick by our mates in difficult times. It's always easy to stick by your mates when everything's going swimmingly. But I think the true test of friendship is sticking with your mates when things are tough. And as you know, we have New Zealand is in an entirely different position. It's not a comment in any way, shape or form directed at New Zealand. But in the case of Australia and the Americans, we are mates and we stick with our mates in difficult times as well as easy times. Just as, let me say, New Zealand sticks with us through difficult times and easy times. We had some difficult times in... more recently in East Timor and in Solomon Islands. Who is always there with us? Who can we always rely on? I'll tell you who we can always rely on. New Zealand. Can always rely on them. We may not privately always agree on everything and everything we each say and all of our tactics and strategies, but we stick together. With us and the Americans, we have a very difficult situation in Iraq, I think, as Winston's put it very eloquently. I mean, obviously, just to walk out of the place is going to leave a simply horrific situation, and I've talked about the impact that would have on stability and security, counter-terrorism in Southeast Asia. We are in Australia, we are next to Southeast Asia, so that is a real issue for us. There's another argument. Well, should we just pull out and say to the Americans, well, you do it all? Well, I don't think that's the way you treat your mates.
Are they aimed at stopping the browning of New Zealand as Tariana-Tiri in the Hemisphere?
Sorry,
your immigration policies, yes. Are they aimed at stopping the browning of New Zealand as Tariana-Tiri?
Well, look, I can't hardly be responsible for the comments of Tariana-Tiri, but I had a kind of thought that in the space of 2 weeks she's contradicted herself. 2 weeks ago she said that immigration was actually contrary to the interests of the Maori people because it would diminish their percentages in the population. 2 weeks later she's saying something different.
Well, no, she's saying the same thing.
No, she's not. Totally converse. But then, of course, the number of politicians who make contrary statements without any regard to consistency in New Zealand is legend. I'm not one of them.
Do you think that the drive to get Western countries to migrate to this country, that's what you're talking about, that there's too much emphasis on Western countries and not enough maybe on Asian or
Well, she should make up her mind, but because way back in 1995, the then National Party promised to deliver a better English language standard when they were in government, and they didn't. It's finally being addressed now in 2007 by the Minister of Immigration. The tragedy of that, of course, is that in the meantime you have so many thousands and thousands of misplaced people not aligned to jobs, occupations or futures, which cannot be explained away than anything other than careless, wanton neglect of the country's long-term economic, social, national interest. But I'm pleased to say that the circumstances changing now to a proper requisite immigration regime requiring people to have an English language standard. Because it happens to be the fact that in the modern context, you want trained, flexible minds, not just hands, and those minds have to be capable of speaking the language. Now, that's not unique to New Zealand. Many other countries have applied that standard, and no more so than all the Asian countries about whom we speak.
Has New Zealand been asked to increase the level of its commitment in Afghanistan?
Let me be honest and say that other countries that are engaged in Afghanistan have constantly asked of all of us, each of the parties engaged there, for a greater commitment. The question is what is warranted in the circumstances. And that is what's being decided by the New Zealand government now.
Did that possibility come up in reports today? No,
not in that context. But let me make it very clear. I don't think there's any government engaged in Afghanistan that has been asked, can you not do a little bit more?
Thanks, so I thought, sorry, I just got to keep it
there. Excellent.
Thanks very much. We'll rush away.